Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears, and our guest for this interview is the playwright and director Tim Luscombe, whose latest play is called Hungry Ghosts and is currently running at the Orange Tree Theatre in Richmond. Tim's many other plays include Eurovision, The One You Love, and The Schumann Plan, and his adaptation of Jane Austen's Northanger Abbey has enjoyed several successful productions. As a director, he's worked in the West End and all over the UK, including five productions at the Chichester Festival, as well as abroad. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Tim.
Thank you very much.
Let's begin by talking about the origins of Hungry Ghosts.
Sure. Well, I've long wanted to write a play about Formula One, partly because I love it, and also very puzzled by it, and sort of seduced by the glamour of it and the excitement of it. It's really the only sport I watch on TV, but also horrified sometimes by the politics that underlie it. And then when I found out that its origins were really were between two fascist dictators, Mussolini and Hitler, racing their Alfa Romeos and Ferraris, then I realised that there was something that made a lot of sense to me, because it's still European, blonde, pretty, rich boys and a few South American races, and I just thought, oh yes, that makes sense. And then, of course, not the current FIA president, but the previous FIA president, who was only left a year ago, was Max Mosley. Now, as far as I know, he's not a fascist at all, but his dad was a fairly famous fascist.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it still has those overtones.
It's also very gladiatorial, isn't it? It's always one man against
another,
isn't it?
But yeah, with the backing of vast corporations and the idea of what they called it, Crashgate, last year, when Flavio Briatore, the team principal of Renault, asked one of his drivers to crash. I thought, well, my goodness, I know there's abuses that go on in horse racing and match fixing in football, but that's quite extraordinary when you're asking a driver to crash. Not only could the driver have died, but he could have caused the deaths of other drivers. But they willing
spectators as well.
Indeed, yeah. Yes, I mean, Singapore is a new circuit. It was which is where this Crashgate happened. And nobody really knew the circuit very well, so it could easily have injured or killed lots of people. And I just thought, well, you know, nobody's written a play, as far as I know, about Formula One. Let's do it. But a story didn't immediately emerge, because, to be honest, when I started writing it, this was way before Crashgate, though I think there is definitely a film or a play in that. And then I thought, well, where am I going to set it? Well, if I set it in China, as soon as I thought that, then a play started to emerge. Just the clash between corporate Europe and communist China was fascinating. And I think it was about the same time that I read in The Guardian that there was this Chinese student, obviously being a student in Britain at Manchester University, I assume, in Manchester on a Saturday afternoon, handing out leaflets. This is a story in The Guardian about 4 years ago. Handing out leaflets highlighting the abuses of the one-child policy China.
And this is the kind of dictatorial policy that each family is only allowed to have one child.
Yes, unless there are certain exemptions, like if you for a farm worker and various ethnic groups and so on. But basically, the Han Chinese are only allowed one child each, certainly in the urban areas. And the article concluded with how brave this student was. Mm. And I thought, really brave on a Saturday afternoon in Manchester? That's extraordinary. I wonder why that is. I started to research dissidents in China who were highlighting the abuse of one-child policy, and there was one blind campaigner who happened to be blind, but he was a campaigner against one-child abuse, and he'd been beaten up serially and then arrested, and his case had gone against him and so on, and all he was trying to do was just highlight the abuses. So I thought, that was my way in, and that's why One Child is kind of featured in the play, I suppose. Yep. But really, when it came to writing the play, the woman dissident who's featured has more at stake than just the One Child policy.
Could you give a sort of plot summary of the situation of the play?
It's hard because it's such a rangy play, but broadly speaking, a British Formula One racing driver, towards the end of his career, goes to take part in the Shanghai Grand Prix as part of the Formula One circuit, and is trailed all weekend by a Chinese Communist Party journalist writing for the Shanghai People's Daily, a fictitious paper, as far as I know. When Tyler, the racing driver, meets the journalist's sister, he's then allowed an insight into China in a way that few tourists are. And that's really the beginning of the play. The play then moves forward when you discover that the journalist and his sister's other sister is in prison awaiting execution for treason.
It's a terrifying... I mean, you know, execution.
Yes.
I mean, I must say, when I saw the play, I did gasp, because in the end, what has she actually done?
She stole some... I made this all up, fairly typical case. She stole some papers from the ministry for which she works, which obviously were official and secret, and she stole them in order to give to her sister, who was campaigning, putting together a case about something. We never find out what it is, but she needed these papers as incrimination.
Yeah, she's a lawyer.
That's
and everything.
Right. Yeah.
And she's caught and condemned to death.
Yes.
To be shot in the back of the head.
Yeah. There is a lot of that going on.
Can we explore perhaps the play's politics a bit? You based some of the references on a group or movement called Charter 08.
I don't think anybody in the play, none of the characters belong to Charter 08, but Charter 08 was something formed in 2008, alongside the Olympics. A pro-democracy group that wants to liberalise China and push the Communist Party towards democracy. It's been ruthlessly repressed in China ever since, and some famous names have been imprisoned who supported it and signed the
charter. Yeah. The motor racing, the driver Tyler... He's both a celebrity in your play, but he's also a commodity, isn't he?
Yeah.
Because he's actually used and exploited a lot, especially by the boss, Baz.
Yeah.
Can you talk us through a bit about him?
Sure, yes. I suppose one of the reasons for wanting to write the play was just to show some of the problems in communist China, but also to sort of say, well, actually, corporatist Europe isn't any better in some respects. Mm. And that Tyler, as you say, is a commodity. He's owned by his team, by the sponsors, by the stakeholders in the corporation that sponsor him, and by the by my fictitious character Baz, who is kind of like the Bernie Eccleston figure, who owns the TV rights, and therefore Tyler is one of his TV stars, and he has to perform. And in the same way, Zhu Hui, who is the Chinese journalist, he's also at the beck and call of his party bosses. So they're both trapped, and they both see each other as being trapped, but they don't see themselves as being trapped.
Yes, it's very interesting, that kind of different perspective.
Yeah. So as soon as Zhu Hui starts attacking Tyler as being a corporate widget, as he calls him, a puppet, then Tyler feels on very safe ground to turn the assault back onto Zhu Hui and say, well, you know, we all have things we protect, and I suppose we all have things we stand up for.
Mm. I mean, they're both appealing characters, and they both have a sort of fraught relationship with their fathers. Mm. Could you sort of explain a bit of that?
Yeah, it was. I suppose the father-son thing became more important to me than the mother-daughter thing. Mm. In the early drafts, there was in fact, the leading character has completely gone. She was Tyler's girlfriend. She was character, and she was pregnant and didn't want the baby, and then there were all these Chinese women who wanted their babies but couldn't have them. But the play moved right away from that and became much more about fathers and sons. Mm. And it's just that Tyler has this history with his father. His father was also a racing driver, and like Graham Hill, Damon Hill, Gilles Villeneuve, Jacques Villeneuve, the father dies on track, and the son then goes on to take the place of the father in the car and drive to somehow vindicate the father or to assuage their guilt about their father's death, whatever it is, I'm not sure. But Tyler feels guilt about his father's death for reasons that become apparent in the play. And he uses this story in order to try and evince a confession from Zhu Hui about his guilt, about his father's death, and fails miserably because, in fact, the two stories are really incomparable. Tyler seems very paltry and superficial when compared to Zhu Hui's suffering.
Exactly. And in China, obviously, you refer a lot back to the Cultural Revolution, which is something people probably don't... I have no idea about China. I'm just like your Westerners in the play.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea. But I imagine that it's not very much discussed in China.
That's right.
But could you talk us a bit through the kind of things that happened? I mean, some of the most grueling episode is when that entire Chinese family, because it's a family drama between a brother and two sisters, only one of which we see, talks about their past.
Absolutely. Yes. I thought it was worth exploring, partly because, as you say, it isn't. It hasn't. Unlike in South Africa, where there's been a whole reconciliation period and process, in China that hasn't happened. The party who was in power then are the party who are in power now. And although they have a much friendlier face to the rest of the world, They are, in fact, they are the direct descendants of the people who obviously repressed the students in Tiananmen Square, but also brought about the Cultural Revolution. Now, this present communist government says that Mao was 30% wrong and 70% right in his whole efforts. But there is still...
It's totally meaningless.
<isn't> it? Yeah, I think they love their statistics. But
it's almost Western in its emptiness, isn't it? Yeah, got that.
There is a sort of unwillingness to deal with the past, certainly. Yeah. Better to raise the past and build a new China. And once China is rebuilt, then it's time to look back at the past. When that will ever come, we don't know. We're not told. But, so I wanted to talk about the Cultural Revolution in terms of... really helping a Western audience understand it, because as you say, although it's not discussed in China, it's very little known here too, but with amongst the general public. That was my aim, really. And yes, it's about a time from 67 to 76 when, particularly for the first few years of that time, you couldn't trust anybody, because it was certainly to your advantage if you spied not only on your neighbours and colleagues, but on your own family. And that's what happens to the family in the play.
Did you do a lot of research into history and so on? Did you go to China?
I've been to China a couple of times, to Shanghai, but I mostly researched by talking to Chinese people in Britain and also reading books. So I didn't have any research to do for Formula One, because I...
You're a fanatic.
Yes, a misspent youth sitting in front of the television watching Formula One. I knew it all, but I didn't know much about China. Okay. So I did a great deal of research, yes.
What makes the lawyer... I think Pinder, tick as a character, because she's obviously concerned with justice, but it seems to us so quixotic, because she's up against these huge powers that basically will allow her to do very little.
Yes, that's right. As her brother says to her at one point, if you had a million soldiers, the party would still crush you. And that is what she's up against, exactly that. She's a lawyer, but every year she has to get her practice license to practice renewed by the party bosses, and if they don't like her, they won't renew it. So she's up against it when the media, the courts and the unions are all controlled by the party. There's not much room for movement. And yet, as she says at one point, we can, even if we don't win a case, we can still embarrass the party. And her aim, what moves her, is to move China closer to its own laws, to outline the laws that China has for itself and make it accountable to those laws. The right to do almost anything in China is there in the constitution. It's just that the Communist Party don't let people, practice those rights. And so that's her aim. She knows she's up against it, and she knows when it comes to it that her fate is probably to die in the cause. But she is so concerned to follow that cause, and in the play in particular, to save her sister's life, as you say, that she persists doggedly. She's as dogged in her defence of the rights of individuals as her brother is dogged in the defence of the party.
That gives that kind of dramatic tension at the centre of the play. In the programme, you say the Chinese Communist Party is all about winning back the dignity that China lost after the humiliating Opium Wars with the English.
I wish I hadn't said that.
Why is
because,
that?
Because I had so much stick from it in the reviews. The reviews tend to review the programme notes, not the play itself. And
here's your chance to bite back. I don't see it as an exceptional... I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be the English, but it is China against the West, isn't it? Still?
Well, that's right. I mean, when the Communist Party came to power in 1949... China had gone through a century, if not more, of massive humiliations. I mean, large chunks of its territory just commandeered for Western powers, by the Western powers, in very unfair, punitive treaties. And so China felt humiliated, and the Communist Party, I don't know whether it's true to say that a lot of their raison d'etre was to win the international prestige back, but I'm sure that was underlying a lot of it. It was a nationalistic, and China, and the Communist Party is an incredibly nationalistic power in China, really wants to assert its place in the world. I mean, for 18 out of the last 20 centuries, China was the most productive, powerful country in the world. It's only in the last two centuries that that's not been the case. So it's only now really beginning to gain its rightful place on the world stage again.
And actually, recently, it even said that it might use force to regain Taiwan. It is so Absolutely. Nationalistic that it, yeah. as a system of government, it can't accept the fact that Taiwan is independent.
Absolutely. Just as Macau and Hong Kong are part of mainland China now, they see Taiwan in the same bracket. And I'm not saying that China has had an aggressive nationalistic policy. Quite the opposite. It has been content to look after its own internal affairs. And when anybody's tried to interfere with those, it's said, no, we don't interfere with yours, so please don't interfere with ours. And it's there's been justification for that. But I think as its power grows, I don't see it retaining that position. I imagine it will become more militaristically involved in the world.
Some of the most delightful lines in the play are exactly this clash of cultures. Every time a Chinese person sees a Westerner, how they are trying desperately to understand what's going on. And I think Liv, who's the PR for Tyler's team, I think she says at one point, a tiny bit of knowledge, you spend a few hours downtown and suddenly you've got China.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that what you felt also, that you were just scratching the surface when you were there?
Absolutely. And it's not up to me to change China either. You know, as Liv says at the end, you know, you're just, to Tyler, you're just one white Westerner, darling, or something. It's up to the Chinese to change China, and that's absolutely right. I didn't write it to change China. It's not my job, and it's not within my power. But I wrote it to inform my audience, you know, middle class theatre goers in Richmond, in this case, to open their eyes to the truth of what's going on. We are in bed with China economically. You know, they and other third world developing countries own our debt and America's debt, so they have us by the short and curlies. They can devalue or up value as much as they like, and there's not much we can do about it apart from make a lot of noise. So I just think it's really important to explore our bedfellow, you know, and be real about what we're in bed with.
As somebody who's been in British theatre for quite a number of years, what do you think? Why do you think there are so few plays about China?
I don't know. It seems to me that I often write plays set in other countries with foreign characters, and it's very unpopular. I pitched a play at the Royal Court recently. It was set in the Baltic. All the characters were either Latvian or Lithuanian or Estonian or Russian, and the man I spoke to at the Royal Court said, well, if we wanted a Lithuanian play, we'd get a Lithuanian playwright to write it. Mm-hmm. We have links with European theatres, and if we want something on Latvia, we'll have a Latvian production. Mm-hmm. So why don't you write about the implication was, why don't you write about what you know about? Well, you know, I know about that, you know, a little bit, and I had something to say about it. To me, it's not interesting to write another, I don't know, play about drug addicts in Peckham, or a family drama set in Somerset, or something like that. That's done to death.
It is.
You know, and yeah, it doesn't interest me. It's not what I go to the theatre for. I want to go to the theatre to see something new. And exactly. I think I have the right to write. You know, Shakespeare didn't balk at writing about Veronese people and Genoans.
Exactly. And also people he obviously didn't know anything about.
Exactly. I don't think he ever went to Genoa or Verona. Yeah.
Exactly. One last point about your play is, politically, it's a bit of a downer in that the characters do stand up for human rights, but they are crushed. Although at the end there's this idea that water can split a stone through drip, drip, drip. Is that something you believe, you think is right?
Well, I think history tells us that that's true, isn't it? I mean, sitting in England in 1987, my impression is that the Berlin Wall would never come down. Yes. That it was there before I was born, and it would be there well long after I was dead. But no, you know, in the autumn of 1988-89, it fell, and that was only because of several acts of attrition that eventually it came to a crisis point and it went. Well, yes, I think China will change. I don't think it has to change. There seems to be, and China has proven this to be true, no need for a capitalist country to be democratic. I think that was the West's big mistake. We always assumed that with trade would come growing democracy. Well, that's proved to be very, very untrue.
And the irony, of course, is that that's a Marxist or a communist way of looking at the world, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That economic changes will
lead to social change. Exactly. But not so far in China. Yeah. But never say never. And I just think, particularly with the downturn in the world economy, they may come to a point where change is inevitable. It will be bloody and it won't be pretty, but it will happen, I'm sure. And it won't necessarily form what we think of as an ideal Western-style democracy. I'm sure that isn't right for every nation, but they'll have to find their own way of letting the lid off, you know, this boiling pot, because there's so much anger and rage and injustice. I hope that's not just idealistic. It seems to me that it will happen. It's just a matter of time, and things move very, very slowly in China, very slowly indeed, so it might not be within our lifetimes.
On that cautious note, thank you very much, Tim.
Thank you.